Welcome to Lucas Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. On November 6th, Washington State voters will have a chance to vote on an initiative that would put a fee on the state's largest polluters, including the oil industry and utilities that have not switched over to clean energy. These fees will be used to protect Washington's clean air and water and fund new clean energy infrastructure across the state. Today we talk with Nick Abraham, Communications Director for Yes on 1631, about why this initiative is critical for helping Washington State and the rest of the region not only meet its carbon reduction goals, but also provide a healthy future for the next generation. Nick, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hey, Barbara, it's good to talk to you again.
Yes, I guess the last time we talked, you were working for Sightline, so you've been moving on.
That is right, a couple years ago, yeah.
So I wanted to start by talking about how this initiative is different from the current carbon tax in British Columbia and the cap and trade in California, because those are both seen as ways of curbing carbon emissions and helping the state and the province to reach their carbon emission goals or reduction goals. In what ways is this initiative similar, and what ways is it different?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We do have a couple of examples here on the west coast of North America. And I think the biggest difference I'll start with is that, you know, we tried to learn a lot of lessons from both of those programs to try and make sure that Washington was doing this in the best way possible. So, you know, British Columbia's had a carbon tax up there for a little bit, but it's had a little bit of trouble over time reducing as much emissions as they thought it would. They've been struggling to meet their goals just on a price signal alone. One thing that we try and do, and that they did down in California, is make sure that the price signal that you're gaining revenue from is invested back into clean energy and the solutions we know reduce pollution. So that's one piece that we tried to learn. I think the second one is about equity. In California's program, when it initially started, did not take into account, historic inequities in pollution. You know, communities of color, low-income folks, a lot of people in rural communities are affected a lot more by pollution and the effects of climate change. And we tried to make sure that those communities were put front and center in our policy, helped design the policy, and are at the forefront of where these investments are going.
Well, one of the things I think about in British Columbia is that while they've had these very ambitious goals to reduce their carbon emissions by, I'm not sure whether it's 2040 or 2050, they also have had incredible pressure to increase their fossil fuel infrastructure. And I mean, the fight that's going on right now about the Trans Mountain Pipeline that would go to Burnaby and feed tar sands oil into the greater Vancouver area, put it on barges. I mean, there's a lot of examples. Also, this huge LNG development going on in Vancouver, and they have a lot of other fossil fuels. So how do you balance that? Because Washington State has almost as much pressure as British Columbia does to increase its fossil fuel infrastructure, and there's two big battles going on right now, one in Longview and another one in Tacoma. How would this initiative maybe make a dent on starting to put a freeze on fossil fuel infrastructure?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And Washington has been, as you know, and as people across Southwest Washington know, they have been right in the crosshairs of the oil industry for a long time. And thankfully, people have been standing up and have been putting themselves on the line to stop those projects. Organizations that are part of Yes on 1631 have been fighting those battles as well. I think there's kind of two sides to the coin here. You know, we need to stop the new infrastructure that these folks are trying to build, and Washington has been unbelievably successful in that. I think when all these coal and oil terminals were first proposed 5 years ago, I don't think we thought we would be able to stop all of them. But so far, there hasn't been a single new one built, and that's absolutely because of people's grassroots energy being able to stop this thing. I think what we see as the other side is that, while we are saying no to these projects, while we are stopping the bad ideas from coming to Washington, that we are actively investing in the solutions we know work. And, while we are stopping those projects, we need to also have the other side of showing people what we can build, giving them a vision for what would be different. And that's exactly what we're trying to do with this initiative.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the sources of pollution and revenue. I'm looking at these pie charts and graphs that you sent me. And the pie charts make sense. The graph is very confusing. So I won't describe that to listeners, but we'll try to make sense of that as well. But first, let's start with the sources of the pollution and how that would provide the revenue for the funds that you're talking about to provide, to create the new infrastructure, the renewable infrastructure that we all need in order to move forward in this climate-changed world.
Yeah, you know, we have an opportunity to showcase what we can do in Washington and present that to the rest of the country for what's a good path for us to build here. You know, what we're talking about investing in here is, you know, things like wind and solar, of course, energy efficiency to make sure that, you know, schools and community centers and people's homes, businesses, they're all saving money on their energy bills, that we're using less, but we're still getting just as much from it. You know, this is talking about building new public transit, you know, investing in more bus lines, more access for people. And, you know, the other side of this is we know one of the best ways to clean up pollution in our state is by investing in the natural resources that can do it by their natural processes. So, you know, making sure that we're investing in healthier forests, that they're more resilient to fire, that they are protected against pest infestation, all these things we know are going to get worse as the climate changes, and investing in our water system so that, you know, the things we know need to grow from strong rivers, having healthy salmon runs, all those things that are going to be invested back into our state to make sure that we are thriving as much as we possibly can.
So who's going to be paying for this? Who will the fee be imposed upon?
Yeah, you know, the bulk of this fee is going to be paid by the oil industry. You know, we still have a fairly sizable presence in Washington, and some folks aren't always aware of that. But, yeah, you know, the point that this fee is going to be charged at is right at the distribution level, which is all the that's where all the oil industry folks are. And then it's on the utilities that haven't yet switched over to clean energy. And that one's a really unique piece. You know, utilities are sort of uniquely positioned to be able to invest in clean energy and energy efficiency. You know, they are tied and supposed to be serving the public. You know, they're a regulated monopoly. So basically what that means is that, you know, we have a little bit greater chance to work with them to be able to make these investments. So they are charged the fee, but if they can find ways to invest in clean energy, lower their pollution on their own, they won't be charged, and they can invest that money in better solutions.
So what about the oil industry? What can they do? Because unless they actually change their product, how can they get out of the fee?
Right. You know, unfortunately, the oil industry has not been a good partner in this. You know, they are spending all of the money for the No campaign. You know, they're up to $20 million right now, which is just shy of the record for most money spent in any election in Washington state history. So we're up against a big fight. They are, you know, this is not a solution they like, but they have never found a solution that they like. You know, this is, you know, the fifth or sixth time that we've tried to do something in this state, and every single time the ones on the other end fighting it, telling us that this isn't the right solution for us, is the oil industry. Now, you know, they have plenty of opportunity to invest in cleaner fuels, lowering emissions at the refinery level, but they have historically chosen not to do that. And there are plenty of solutions, plenty of ways that we know work, and we would hope that they would take advantage of those rather than, you know, being an obstacle to this solution.
So let's name some of the actors here. So let's start with the fossil fuel industry in Washington. Who are the companies that would be hit with the biggest fees, and who are the companies that are donating the most money to the No on 1631 campaign?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be a pretty similar list, unsurprisingly. So, you know, the refineries in Washington are BP, Shell, Andover, which used to be Tesoro, and folks in Southwest Washington are very familiar with that company because they were the ones fighting for the oil terminal, and they're back again in Washington politics fighting against this initiative. U.S. Oil in Tacoma, and then there's a few other, you know, sort of large emitters in up and down the inland coast of Washington that are refining level. You know, this is going to be on you know, the utilities, again, that haven't yet switched over to clean energy. So that's, you know, folks like Puget Sound Energy, you know, and some of the, like, smaller, more regional utilities. But, again, a lot of those utilities are going to be partners in this, and they're going to be investing in other ways that we can build out clean energy.
Well, I'm just thinking some of the big names. I mean, you sort of ran real quick Puget Sound Energy, but Puget Sound Energy is a very known bad actor in the Tacoma area, where they're trying to build a very large LNG facility at the port. And I've been hearing a lot about Puget Sound Energy in the last few months, and I think one of the things that's interesting is that they're not, they have nothing to do with Puget Sound. They actually are an Australian-owned company, and they have very little vested interest in what happens locally in the state of Washington. And I wonder if we could talk a bit about that as well, and comparing them to, it's hard to get from Andover, to get to Andover from Tesoro, so let's call them Tesoro Andover. They've also
that's
had,
me, yeah.
And then another player, of course, is U.S. Oil, which I'd like to remind Oregon listeners, U.S. Oil was the refinery that the train that derailed in Mosier and caught horrific fire was heading up to U.S. Oil in Tacoma. So there's a link
right,
there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, look, how much these companies have put money into Washington state politics for a long time. I mean, your former colleague at Sightline, Eric DePlace, has written a lot about that. So I'd like to see, like, talk a little bit about the history of these companies in trying to dominate politics in Washington state, and how successful they've been, actually, and how this initiative could possibly counter that influence.
Yeah, so like we said, you know, basically five oil companies and their trade groups account for 99% of the no campaigns funding. So this is entirely backed by big oil, and it's a lot of the same folks, like you just said, that we've been up against for years. You know, Sightline and a few other folks have really done a great job documenting how much funding they've put into Washington state politics, and it is tens of millions of dollars over the last decade. And that's to, you know, lobby the legislature and make sure that they don't implement something like 1631. You know, we have tried a few different ways, a few different times, to try and get something through the legislature, and it's been stalled every single time by the oil lobby. So, you know, after those attempts, we know that Washington state voters want this, and that's why we took it directly to the people, you know, because we know we can pass this if we get everyone to pay attention and get on board to support us this year. You know, so they have been fighting, you know, for things like the coal terminals, the oil terminals. You know, some of these same folks are in bed on both of those sides of the projects. We've seen it a lot more now with liquefied natural gas projects. You know, that's still kind of the next phase of the anti-fossil fuel fight. But yeah, these folks keep popping up again and again in Washington state politics as the barrier to progress. And once again, they are throwing everything they have against this initiative because they know if something like this falls, if we can get something like this passed, their power starts to wane. And this is going to be a direct hit on their monopoly on the rest of us, and it's going to be investing in the solutions we know we need to move away from oil, to move away from coal, to build out more of these clean energy solutions.
So you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Nick Abraham, who is the communications director for the Yes on 1631, an initiative that would put a fee on the state's largest polluters in order to protect Washington's clean air and water and fund new energy, clean energy infrastructure across the state. Well, I was looking at a chart last night of all the politicians in Washington state who've received money from Puget Sound Energy, and it's an astonishing array. And somewhere in the upper third was Jay Inslee, actually. There were several state representatives and senators who were down a little bit lower on the list that represent the Puget Sound area. So I'm just kind of curious, with all this money that goes into the campaign coffers of Washington state politicians from companies like Puget Sound Energy, as well as Tesoro and all the other fossil fuel industries, I'm just wondering, what kind of support are you getting from the local elected officials for 1631?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, Puget Sound Energy is neutral on our initiative. You know, they still have a lot of coal energy that they're using. They still have, they are still fighting for a lot of these fossil fuel infrastructure projects. So, you know, they're by no means doing everything well. But on this particular issue, they've kind of chosen to stay out of it. That being said, with the money that has come in, to try and influence our politics, we have done a pretty impressive job of getting a lot of these political leaders on board. Governor Inslee is one of our strongest advocates. He is constantly working to get this passed. You know, he's been an environmental champion his whole career, so we've been lucky to have him on board with us. But you know, our support is not really focused on political leaders in our state. You know, it's really about the community organizations and the folks who've been fighting for this for a really long time. You know, I think one of the most unique things about our initiative and the coalition we built is that it really centers the communities who are most impacted by pollution, and they were at the table writing this policy, and they're out in front fighting for it now. You know, we have the largest initiative coalition in state history, and that's folks like faith leaders, communities of color, low-income advocates, and, of course, environmental and clean energy organizations. We have over 150 small businesses that are on board, as well as, you know, some of the flagship industries in our state. REI is on board, Vigor Industries in Seattle, Virginia Mason, the health provider. Doctors and nurses know how impactful pollution is on our health, and they've been out in front, one of the strongest voices in support of getting this passed and making sure people are taking action to reduce pollution right now.
Well, I've been getting a lot of emails from you guys talking about how much money the oil companies are raising, and I guess they're going to be putting or are putting TV ads on in Washington State. And I wanted to talk a little bit about their campaign against the initiative and how you, what are some of their techniques and tactics?
Yeah, so they are very insidious. They're not out in front telling you that they're the oil industry. I'm sure folks have seen their TV ads where they try and prop up a small business person in front of them. I'm sure folks have gotten their mailers that are spreading false information about our campaign. You know, I think going into this fight, we knew that they were going to be, they would try dirty tactics and do things like this. I don't think we thought they would peddle as much absolute lies directly to voters. So they have been putting out, they're going to run a very, money-driven campaign. They're going to not—they're not going to have rallies. They're not going to have people knocking on your door. It's going to be all TV and mail, and they're just trying to try and flood folks to scare them away from this initiative. And that's historically what they've always done, to try and scare people away from the solutions they know work. So yes, they're going to be up on TV. Yes, they definitely have. They're going to raise more money than us. We know going into this campaign we would, but you know, we've also got ads we're running as well, but I think our strength and the way we know we can win this campaign, and I think what's most important for listeners to hear is that, you know, we have the people power on our side. You know, they're never going to match us on doors knocked, on phone calls made, on talking neighbor to neighbor. That's the best way that we can combat their money, is real people talking to each other about why they support this and why it's important that we take action now. So, you know, we had 350,000 people sign to get this on the ballot, and we've had thousands and thousands of volunteers, you know, every single week out across the state talking with folks to try and get this passed. So this is a absolute, you know, money versus people campaign, and I think we knew that's how it was going to be going into it, but it's going to be a real testament to what Washington State voters can do to battle against this money. I think if we can win this thing, it will send a message that, you know, there are limits to how much big fossil fuel producers, big corporations can do to influence our politics if people are organized and get together on a solution that they believe in.
Well, this isn't the first time that Washington State has tried to have to levy some kind of fee on carbon pollution. I think before this, it was all done at the legislative level, and my understanding is it got torpedoed by the oil industry and all the oil industry campaign donations that dominate the statehouse in Olympia. So I'm wondering how this is different as far as getting the word out. Is it perhaps the difference between trying to reach the electorate as opposed to trying to reach politicians?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to describe it. You know, people in this state know that pollution is a problem. They see it in their daily lives. They see the destruction that, you know, the, you know, 600,000 people in the state are living with asthma right now. You know, the Yakima, Washington has had 84 bad air days last year, which puts them on par with some of the worst cities in the country. So I think we think of ourselves as a very green, clean state, but we're also seeing the effects that pollution is having on our daily lives and the effects that climate change is having on how things in our state are changing from what they've historically been in our past. So, you know, I think people have absolutely woken up to the need to act. Really now, what we're looking to do is try and make sure that people know that what the opposition is saying is absolutely false. So when they're talking about that this, you know, won't actually reduce pollution, that it'll cost too much, you know, they are doing that completely dishonestly, and they know that they're peddling misinformation. But, you know, the best way we know to combat that is real people talking to each other to tell folks, this is not true. We know this isn't true. We trust the organizations and the people that are backing this campaign, you know, and they're gonna be able to see through that in the end, and we're going to be able to win this thing.
Well, I'm kind of curious about what are some of the arguments that they're making, and how do you – I'd like to hear the specific arguments that your opponents are making, and what is your rebuttal to those arguments?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. You know, I think the main one is that this exempts the largest polluters when, in fact, it is a fee on the state's largest polluters. You know, they are putting a picture of the TransAlta coal plant on every mail that they're sending out. It's in all their TV ads, and that's their big example of how we are exempting the largest polluters and in putting this cost on them. And they know for a fact that the TransAlta coal plant is shutting down, it starts shutting down the very same year this initiative goes into effect. So it's not exempt. It's already going by the wayside. So, you know, the TransAlta coal plant is a really good example of exactly what we're trying to do across the state.
Let's talk about what is the TransAlta coal plant and where is it?
Oh yeah, so it's just outside Centralia, Washington. It is, you know, our last coal plant that's directly in Washington State. We still get a lot of coal power from places like Montana, but this is our last plant that's actually physically in Washington. And they've had a deal for several years to shut down and transition their power into clean energy and new jobs and new opportunities for the community that's been around it. So, you know, those are all kind of the hallmarks of what we want to do with this policy. And, you know, I think it's actually a really great example of what we're trying to do. We're trying to, you know, give a just transition to the community that that lived and worked for some of these fossil fuel industries. And that's why, you know, labor unions and workers have been such a big part of our campaign. And they're now transitioning that plant to the largest one of the largest wind projects and the largest solar farm in Washington State. You know, this is a perfect example of what we want to build with this, and our opposition, in a really dishonest way, is trying to make it seem like that's the opposite, that's the example of why we shouldn't do this, when in fact it's a perfect example of what we want to build for Washington.
Give me a couple other examples of distortions that they have thrown at you.
Yeah, you know, they keep saying that this is going to be you know, billions in dollars of costs for small businesses. And, you know, this burden is going to be placed on low-income folks and, you know, the people who can least afford it. You know, that is just absolutely false. You know, this is a fee on the largest polluters. We designed it specifically so, you know, these large corporations who have been causing the most harm are the ones who should be paying to fix the problem in the first place. And, you know, our partners in low-income communities and communities of color, rural folks, they're the ones who have been dealing with the worst effects of pollution. They're the ones crying out the loudest that we need to do something about this. So, you know, our campaign is in particular really upset about this argument, and we've been trying to get folks to understand that, you know, when they're trying to put low-income people out in front, those folks are not on their side. They're standing with our campaign and help design this policy so that it worked for their communities.
So how are you showing that and getting that word out?
Yeah, you know, they have, you know, folks like Front and Centered, which is a coalition of 60 different community of color organizations across Washington State, have been one of our strongest advocates. You know, they are out talking with their communities. They're, you know, speaking directly to voters themselves. You know, it's in the same traditional ways that we've always done that in mailers and TV ads and that kind of thing. But, you know, really what it's going to be is the community organizations that people have trusted for years telling them the truth about what this initiative does.
So how is this initiative going to go about actually reducing your carbon emissions? I mean, I'm looking now. This is the graph. It doesn't make any sense to me. Millions of metric tons of CO2. It's on the vertical column. And then there's a bunch of years, and then there's this thing that says business as usual, and there's a line that keeps going up, and price impact, electric fuel, mixed reductions, other strategies, and emissions. So can you explain to me what this all means?
Yeah, and you know we're in trouble if we're trying to explain graphs over the radio.
Right.
But, yeah, no, I think the main way to frame this for folks to understand who are listening is, you know, Washington State in 2008 passed requirements and laws and a law for how much pollution Washington needed to reduce. So these are like state goals that are in statute, that are in the law, that say we need to reduce emissions by 25 million tons a year by 2035. So basically taking the place we're at right now overall that we produce every year and lowering that by 25 million tons. So our initiative is directly tied to those goals, but you know, for the last 10 years, we've had goals set by the state, but with no plan to get there. So this is a direct plan for how to invest to get to those targets. You know, so the way we're going to get there is partially through the fee on these polluters. You know, that in itself will reduce some pollution, just putting a price signal on this so folks are actually taking into account the costs of pollution. But the other side is investing in the actual solutions. You know, we know that if we transition from something that's, you know, historically polluting, a fossil fuel, to solar, wind, more efficient energy, that's going to reduce pollution just on its face. You know, but other solutions like, you know, having our forests more resilient, more healthy, so they can soak up more of the pollution in our air, you know, that is historically viewed over time. There are thousands of reports and scientific studies that show that this is going to do this. But I think the main piece to talk about here is the accountability of this policy. And we are not just leaving this in the hands of the gridlock and political divisiveness of the legislature. We are creating a 15-member board that will be appointed by the governor, but is going to, you know, it has really specific requirements who's going to be on it. So it needs to be health professionals, business leaders, you know, scientists, experts in their field, and community leaders who can help design the plan for us to get to these pollution reduction goals. You know, that the legislature still gets to, you know, approve the plan and appropriate the money and everything, but, you know, having this community involvement, having these experts at the table designing this helps to make sure that we are reaching those goals and we're listening to the people who know the most about this.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Nick Abraham, Communications Director for the Yes on 1631, the initiative that would start to put a fee on carbon polluters and put create a fund to actually move away from carbon pollution. The commission that you just described, it kind of reminds me a little bit when Oregon established its land use laws in 1973. There were all kinds of commissions that were created to enforce those land use laws. And then there was the outside government body, which was Thousand Friends of Oregon, which was like the watchdog group to make sure it happened. And it seems like both of those things are important. I'm wondering if you're thinking about having a watchdog group once this initiative is passed that would, from the outside, keep harping on, you're not doing it right, you're not doing it right, this is the way you have to do it.
Right. No, I'm really glad you brought that up. And this is also one of the places that our opposition tries to hit us. They tried to talk about that this is some scary board of bureaucrats that's going to, you know, misappropriate this money. But we have boards like this in Washington already that have been doing great work and involving the public in these decision-making processes for years. You know, the Workforce Development Board is an example where, you know, they appropriate about the same amount of money, and they help the legislature with a plan to invest those funds so that folks can get job training and can transition to, you know, the fast-moving pace of where jobs are going now. So we have really good examples of this working really well in Washington, and I think it's sort of part of who we are in this state. You know, we always want public involvement. We always want full transparency. You know, people always want to know and have a say in where money's going, and that's exactly why I created this board. And, you know, as far as the watchdog piece, you know, this is we embedded accountability into this policy. It will be audited every 4 years by an independent group to make sure that, you know, we are on pace to reach our goals, that, you know, the money is going to the places that need it most. So there are several fail-safe layers in this thing to make sure it's working and make sure that we are getting to where we need to go.
One of the things that really interests me about this initiative, and it reminds me in a way of the Portland Clean Energy Fund, which is on the ballot, which we'll be talking about in this show in a few weeks, that there in Portland, the case was that initiative was completely driven by communities of color and organizations of people of color. And there's a very, very strong equity piece in it. And I wonder, it seems to me that, I don't know if 1631 was initiated by people of color, but it certainly is concerned about all the people who've been left out of the equation for the last, you know, centuries, that they are brought in, and that this is actually working with these people to really empower them to be part of a renewable future. So I'm wondering, is, first of all, was there a large component of people of color who were involved in crafting 1631? And then how will this initiative, if it's passed, how will that really embolden these communities that have been so disenfranchised to actually take control over their own lives and their own communities?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And it's something that we've been thinking about and have been involved in our process since the very beginning. You know, I think 1631 has sort of two levels where it can be an incredibly historic initiative and hopefully be something that we can replicate across the country. And that's in the policy level. You know, we have never, passed by a vote of the people, put a price on pollution in this country. And so Washington would be able to be the first place to take a practical step here to do something we should have been doing for a long time now, but really take that first step into doing something about it. But I think the other side that we really hope that people take a lot of lessons from is that, you know, so often when these policies are made, it's a few, you know, connected folks in a room talking together that design it for themselves and then go out and try and sell it to other people. And we did the exact opposite. You know, we did the hard work of getting as many folks in the room as we possibly could, and that started off with working families, you know, people that represent working people in this state, of course, the environmental community who's been, you know, fighting for this and understanding these issues for a long time. But I think the really big centerpiece that is really connected to what they're trying to do in Portland as well is the direct involvement and leadership of communities of color in Washington. So they were at, you know, they helped bring this coalition together from the very beginning, and they helped design the policy, and they're now fighting for it and working with to activate the communities that they work with and serve right now until, you know, fighting for Election Day. So, you know, that's something that I think we are incredibly proud of. You know, getting everyone to agree on this and get on the same page, it's harder work. It takes longer, but, you know, it's that old saying of if you want to go far, go together. And we really tried to get as many folks involved and on the same page first, you know, talking about the values that we all share, and then designed a policy based on those. And we think our policy is much stronger for it, but that we finally have the coalition that's ready to take on the oil industry because everyone is on the same page this time.
So what are the specific programs that are going to be funded, and how would they benefit all these people?
Yeah, so there's a couple overlays in our policy that are pretty different than ways we've tried to do this in the past. You know, 35% of all the investments must directly benefit those who are most impacted by pollution. And that's sort of on a health scale, like who has the most, you know, highest asthma rates from pollution, the highest upper respiratory disease, you know, even like cancer studies and that kind of thing. And those are already pretty well documented in our state. We already have all that information. And we know where these people live. So 35% of the investments are going to need to be directly benefiting those folks who have been hardest hit. And that ends up being, I think probably to the surprise of no one, low-income folks, communities of color, but a lot of rural people as well, like the communities surrounding the TransAlta coal plant that we talked about earlier, are have some of the highest rates of these pollution-related illnesses in the state. So those are the type of folks that are going to be, there are provisions in this policy that make sure that they are included in this future. But it's also, the tribal community in our state, the nations that make up Washington State have been directly involved in this process. They have been fighting for it from the very beginning, and they are, this is one of the first policies in the country that really directly recognizes tribal sovereignty in the statute, in the law, and makes sure that they are directly involved in the decision-making process on issues that affect their lands. So, we are really trying to make sure that this is a different avenue this time, and that we are centering those folks who have been historically, unfortunately, left out of this type of process.
So how would they directly benefit? I mean, what kind do you envision any specific projects where these communities would actually be involved and be positively impacted?
Yeah, so, one good example is like low-income weatherization, making sure that folks that, where they're, right now their utility bills is a big part of their spending, making sure that they have, we've retrofit their homes, so we've made sure they have better insulation, that they have, their doors and windows are sealed better. This is one big thing that we know will reduce a lot of pollution, a lot of energy use, if we just invest in those common sense energy efficiency solutions, but it also saves people money on their bills. So it's kind of a two-for-one investment strategy for those folks that need these investments the most. Other ones would be.
What was it before we go on? Would those be at low or no cost to low-income people?
Absolutely, yeah. No, these investments are made from the fund that we're creating, from the fee on the largest polluters. So we're making sure that those companies that are causing the most harm are the ones that are paying for these investments.
And then you're going to give me another example.
Yeah, making sure that there's low-income housing and access near public transit. That's another good way that we know is a really big inequity in a lot of our cities is access to being able to get around. So that's one other way we can do this. But it's also about creating the jobs and the projects, not just in those places that can historically afford it, but making sure that clean energy jobs are accessible to more people in the state. So, that's job training for folks, that's direct jobs and projects that are invested specifically in those communities and hiring from those communities, and making sure that we're investing in protecting workers, that we're giving them income and benefits that they deserve. So all those provisions are built into this policy from the very beginning.
Well, I'm thinking about, three communities in particular, which are being really targeted by fossil fuel industry. I mean,
yeah.
Klamath with methanol refinery, Longview, which has had a long history, a whole parade of every possible fossil fuel infrastructure trying to be built, and currently they're fighting off an anhydrous ammonia plant that they want to build there. And then in Tacoma,
right,
which has a 140 years history of pollution, and where they're currently trying to fight an LNG facility, which is actually being built without permits. And so the argument which is made in each one of these cases, in a really big way in Longview and in Klamath, and to some degree in Tacoma, is we need these jobs, and that the environmentalists, they want to put in coffee shops, instead of having heavy industry. And of course, the wages are really different between heavy industry and being a barista. So I wonder,
right,
how do you change that culture? Because I particularly see that in a place like Longview, which has a long history of kind of taking what it can get at its port and really being a very polluted place for a rural area.
Yeah, We have been working with folks who have historically worked in these industries from the very beginning. You know, the Washington State Labor Council has been a really good partner in this. We have the majority of unions in Washington State that are on board with our initiative, and that's really helped us better understand and have a vision in this policy that protects and invests in working people in the state. You know, we are going to need a whole bunch of new infrastructure if we're going to transition to clean energy. So, you know, we want to use our own steel, our own concrete, our own aluminum, and we have these, manufacturers in our state, and they're going to help us be able to invest in those clean energy solutions that we know we need, but also, you know, protect jobs and have them be a part of the new clean energy economy. So, you know, a lot of these places that have historically relied on manufacturing are going to see a huge boost from the investments we know we can make from this. So we are trying to make sure that we are investing back in our own state and our own workers. I think a big part of this, too, to understand is that, you know, the economy and the world is moving to clean energy, and we have kind of two choices in our hands. We have an opportunity to take advantage of that movement, to invest and be at the forefront of it so that Washington is a leader on it, or we can fall by the wayside and allow other places to pass us without us being involved. And that's going to hurt our economy. That's going to hurt our workers. You know, we need to always be innovating. We need to always be thinking about the future. And I think that's something that Washington has historically done that voters in this state absolutely understand, is that we need to be thinking about where we're going to go next if we're going to continue to have the prosperous, healthy, thriving economy that we've had for several years now.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Nick Abraham, who's the Communications Director for Yes on 1631. We're learning about this initiative, which could really change the carbon landscape in the state of Washington and perhaps spill over into the rest of the Northwest. One of the things you pointed out in the beginning is the difference between this initiative and the carbon tax in, let's say, in British Columbia, is that in British Columbia, they were just relying on market forces to squeeze out carbon polluters. Here, you've got this fund that's actually going to work proactively. So first of all, I'm wondering, how effective is it, do you think, to put a tax or to put a fee on major carbon polluters? Does that really get them to change their ways? And then the second part of the question is, what happens if they all change their ways and there's no more fund?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I think the first piece that's just helpful for people to understand is, you know, there's a legal difference in Washington between a fee and a tax. A fee guarantees that money has to be spent on solving the problem. So we structured it that way on purpose to make sure that, you know, unlike other places like British Columbia that have tried this, we can use that money to invest back in what the problem we're trying to solve in the first place. Whereas a tax can just be kind of used for whatever, you know, the legislature wants to put it towards. You can have a property tax that can go towards education or the general fund or anything like that. So having it be a fee makes sure that the money goes where it's supposed to go. And, you know, I think the biggest piece to understand is kind of the difference, if we're going to get on kind of a policy level, is that, you know, just doing a straight tax across the board with no investment plan, no involvement from people, no involvement from, the folks that are going to be feeling the effects of this, is a really blunt instrument. And it's not worked very well in British Columbia because they haven't been hitting their pollution targets. Their tax hasn't gone up at all. So it's this structure, we really tried to learn the lessons from those places to make sure that we had a plan that would actually work to create the solutions we want. You know, the idea here isn't just to punish companies for what they're doing. It's really to create a pathway and an investment plan so that folks in Washington, in the places they're implementing these policies, have that investment coming into their state. You know, we want to make sure that these workers and the people that, have been involved in this process for a long time actually know where this money's going to go and know what we can invest in.
Well, one problem, though, it seems that companies like Tesero Andover or Millennium Coal or Chevron and BP and all the other oil companies, they are really invested in fossil fuels. This is where, I mean, and they think they can get all that natural gas or frack gas out of the ground before it's too late and you know, make a killing with methanol and liquid natural gas. So what is the fee that they're going to be charged a big enough fee that it actually could make them stop in the tracks and kind of reconsider their accounting?
You know, I think the way that we are going to realign our economy is not directly through the fee, but it's through that investment. You know, this is going to be able to invest $1 billion a year in new clean energy infrastructure. You know, that is going to change the way we do things in this state, you know, on a sensible, reasonable time scale, but we know it's going to be putting us on the path to where we need to go. So whether, you know, whether these companies make those decisions or not, we are going to, Washington State is going to be on a path to clean energy. We don't need to have them tell us, you know, what we can do with our own economy, with our own investments, if we are investing in a path for ourselves. So, you know, rather than trying to, I think we've been for years trying different ways through, you know, through petitions and lobbying to these organizations to try and get them to be on board. And I think what we've said this time around is like, look, we don't want you involved in this process anymore because you've been such a bad faith actor in working with folks. So we're actively cutting fossil fuel companies out of the decision-making process and making sure that we are investing in moving away from their products on our own.
So the next step, though, let's say that you either convert these companies into doing the right thing or you drive them out of the state and there's no more fees being collected because there's no more carbon pollution coming from these companies, then what's going to fund the projects after that?
Well, you know, if we get to that point, we know we will have reached our goals to meet these pollution standards. You know, this is going to cover 80% of pollution in Washington State. You know, so we are going to solve the problem of pollution with this initiative if we are able to slowly make those steps and keep putting our goals a little bit farther ahead and making those small decisions over time to advance the process here. But you know, we know that as the, you know, the fee is going to rise over time on a very reasonable, gradual scale. But as it rises and as pollution is reduced, we're still going to have funds to be able to invest in clean energy. So, you know, if the fund didn't have more money coming in, it basically means that we will have gotten to a place where we are dealing with the problem of pollution. We are, you know, it's sort of inherently that if we're not collecting a fee anymore, if the money's coming in, then we've reached the finish line. We've reached our goal. So that's a really nice tool that it basically solves itself in the process.
So what can listeners both here in Oregon and in Southwest Washington, and any of those of you who are listening around the state and around Washington State as well, what can they do to help your campaign?
Yeah, so there's kind of two ways that listeners and folks across the state can get involved. You know, the first is to go to yeson1631.org. You know, that's our campaign website to be able to find different ways to get involved. And we have, like we said earlier, have thousands of volunteers across the state. You know, this is a chance for people to really be able to have a direct impact on the future they want to create. So by volunteering for this campaign, you are able to take some of that power and be a part of the solution we're building. And I think the other way is just to be talking to your friends, talking to your neighbors, you know, making sure when they are seeing this false information from the oil industry that you make sure you look at the paid-for sign on their ads, on their mailers, and you will see a list of nothing but oil companies who do not have our best interests in mind and are pushing false information. So going to yeson1631.org and really just talking to your friends and neighbors about the truth about this initiative.
And so if this initiative passes, what's the next step?
Oh, man, that's a great question.
Besides a big party afterwards.
All of us on the campaign are really have our blinders on for November 6th, but, you know, making sure that making sure that we implement this the right way, making sure we're going to need other policies to get to our goals. We're going to need other pieces here, down the line, still fighting. A lot of our groups are still going to be working towards, making sure we don't have this new fossil fuel infrastructure. But 1631 is such a key cornerstone of us reaching our goals and finally taking a first step to do something about pollution that, we really feel like this is going to help all the other pieces we know we need to do in Washington to such a big extent that getting this passed is going to make everything that we want to do in the state so much easier.
And I guess my last concern is thinking about the GMO labeling initiative that was on the ballot several years ago, which started out with a whole huge, seeming like it was going to be really successful, widely supported, and it went down actually by not that narrow a margin because the agribusiness pumped so much money into fighting it. So I'm wondering if you have learned lessons from that initiative and if you're prepared to counter the kinds of negative campaigning that actually both happened in Washington for their GMO labeling initiative as well as the one we had in Oregon the next year.
Yeah, no, it's really funny that you bring that up because the same political firm and the same spokesperson that worked for the GMO campaign are behind the fight against 1631 as well. So we have a direct playbook for what they tried to do last time, and they're running about the same game this time around. So, I think there's two pieces that we know we can do that are a lot stronger than what they did, than what the GMO folks tried to do last time. The first one is that we just built such a bigger coalition than we've ever seen in the state. And, that means more boots on the ground, more people that make phone calls, more validators and people that can speak the language of their communities directly to them. That is just something we have never seen before in this state. And I think the second piece is that, we have folks that have learned a lot of lessons on how to undermine and beat the fossil fuel industry at their own game. We had a huge win in stopping the Tesoro oil terminal in Vancouver. A lot of the same groups that worked on that are behind this initiative now. I helped out on the Don Orange campaign. I'm sure a lot of your listeners were involved in that and know that fight. We've learned how to beat these guys. Washington is creating the playbook for how you beat the fossil fuel industry on the political level. And so I think we see now how we can beat these folks, and it's going to be through big coalitions, constantly reminding folks who the opposition is and making sure that we are continuing to tell people that the oil industry is lying to them, that they are not telling the truth, and that they do not have your best interests at heart.
Well, Nick, good luck with the campaign. It's really great to talk to you, and we'll touch base soon, I hope.
Yeah, I really appreciate the time. It's good to hear from you again, Barbara.
Great. And we've been talking today with Nick Abraham, who's the communications director for the Yes on 1631. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LP FM in Seattle. Before we leave, I want to let you know of a couple things coming up in relationship and sort of directly and indirectly to Initiative 1631. There's going to be an event in Vancouver this evening at 6 o'clock at the Downtown Library Columbia Room at 10th and C. And they're calling it The Folly of Frack. It's going to start out with a play called The Folly of Frack and followed by a comment writing workshop to write comments on the new environmental impact statement that's being created for the infamous methanol refinery, the world's largest methanol refinery that's proposed to be built in Kalama. And so you can go to this meeting tonight, learn more about the whole nature of frack gas, why it is such a not a carbon neutral, not a bridge fuel, but a really destructive fossil fuel that needs to be stopped, and how you can work towards making sure that this methanol refinery doesn't happen. So again, it's at 6 o'clock at the Downtown Library in Vancouver, Columbia Room, 10th and C, and it runs from 6 to 8 p.m. Also, I wanted to spend the last few moments of the show today talking about some initiatives here in Oregon that are not quite as exciting in terms of making great social change as Initiative 1631 in Washington State. There are going to be five Oregon ballot measures, and I just was going to run through them really quickly. You can decide, but you should just know that this from 106, well, from 102 to 106, this is what we're facing. Measure 102 would amend the state constitution, allowing public funding to be mixed with private dollars to build privately owned affordable housing. There's some very strong questions about whether you want to use private funding for affordable housing, and that it's sort of a... I'm actually reading this from the Rural Organizing Project's newsletter, that it's a kind of mixed bag and not a very successful and full-reaching method. They're actually saying they're neutral on that one. Measure 103 would amend the Constitution to permanently block taxation on groceries and to freeze the state corporate minimum tax for any business related to the food industry. But it's not really about protecting consumers. It's really about keeping major food companies like Kroger, Costco, and Albertson, Safeway, who've donated $1.96 million to this campaign, to keep them from having their corporate taxes raised. Measure 104 would amend the Constitution to require 3/5 a supermajority vote in the state legislature to eliminate tax breaks for special interests or raise fees. And this, again, would shield Oregon's biggest corporations from any increased fees to pay for rising costs of their use of public resources or to clean up the pollution that they might cause, make it even harder to build, to fund our roads, schools, libraries, public health care, and it would immediately cause cuts in the Oregon Health Plan. So that's something to think about. That was 104. 105 is an attempt to repeal Oregon's state sanctuary law, which prevents local law enforcement and other state agencies from using public resources to aid federal immigration enforcement. And finally, 106 would amend the Constitution to prohibit the allocation of public funds for abortion and related reproductive services, which, in the light of the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings right now, is pretty scary. So just to let you know that there are some very serious initiatives on the ballot here in Oregon that you should educate yourself about and make sure you vote on November 6th, if not before. So once again, you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Kibu Community Radio. And if you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or what your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening. Suddenly